Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
Hi, Aaron. I could barely hear you. I don't know what's going on there.
I was using my indoor voice.
Oh, yeah. My name's Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. They've got everything when it comes to turf. It's summertime. Grass is growing. Go get a new mower and make your life easy. They got lots to choose from. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. Or you can give them a call at 530-226-9226 or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
And our, I guess our free advertisement of the week should go to the Reading Symphony. That was so great.
Yeah, it was nice.
It was so great. Thanks to some friends of ours, they gave us their, they have season tickets, and they couldn't attend last night, and they said, hey, why don't you guys go? And it's like, holy cow, it was amazing. So if you haven't been to the symphony lately, and if you've never been, that would be terrible, but if you haven't been lately, worth going if you live in the Reading area. Symphony is great. So let's see, today, I know you're going to be all shocked. It's Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day to all the moms out there. And you're going to be shocked that we're not talking about pot. I know.
We're not?
I know. We were on a series. We were on a series, and so, you know,
I'm going to go through pot withdrawals now.
It is addicting. It's even addicting to listen to. No, we're going to talk about fire retardant today because... I don't know. Maybe unbeknownst to the public. I'm not sure.
Are they still using that nasty stuff?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my
terrible,
gosh.
Scary fire retardant.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if you live in an area that has fires and the planes fly over and put down fire retardant so your house doesn't burn up and you don't lose your entire community, hopefully, they're trying to get rid of that, which is alarming and distressing. There is a bill pending, and I have posted it. So today is May 14th, 2023, in case we play this on a different day. H.R. 1586, the Forest Protection and Wildland Firefighter Safety Act of 2023, authored and submitted by Congressman Doug LaMalfa and 30 of his closest friends in the House. Probably more, but right now there are 30 co-sponsors. It's a very short bill. A bill to allow the Secretary of the Interior and the Secretary of Agriculture to use fire retardant, chemical, or water for fire suppression control or prevention activities. So, for those of you that wish that the bills were shorter and more succinct, I do believe your dreams have come true today. So we will move forward on why that is a good thing. So I asked Mark to... program note here. December 12, 2010 was the first time Mark was on with us. I think we started the show in October of 2010.
Wow.
So he was like one of our first guests. And I've listed the shows that we have done with him previously, Second Amendment, Focus on Water. And we also did a show in April of 2014. It's on there. It's called the Black Bear Commune. And I got to tell you, if you just want to hear a great story about a bunch of knuckleheads, probably the people that are banning the fire retardant, actually, it's the same crowd. And you just want to hear a true story and just laugh a lot, that is really one worth replaying. It's listed on our page today. So I asked Mark, I said, got to send me a current bio. So he describes himself as a Christian, a husband, a father, and a rancher. Goes on to say, my wife Cindy and I ranch in Siskiyou County, and those are the things I'm most grateful for. How do you go wrong there?
Yeah.
So let's see, Mark's a Vietnam veteran. He was a helicopter door gunner at that time, and we all know how much danger was involved in that. And he continued to fly, actually. Airport transport pilot, 25 years of flying 747s, DC-10s, all over the world, both civilian and military support roles, passengers, and cargo. And during the civilian... during civilian reserve aircraft fleet operations, they flew to conflicts all over the Middle East, Eastern Europe, Africa, and then other places. So I'm assuming other places are just places that he's probably not allowed to talk about. So he's flown pretty much everywhere. 7 years experience flying DC-10, very large air tankers fighting wildfires all over the United States, Chile, and Australia. He has over 23,000 flight hours. Also 10 years experience as a reserve deputy sheriff, involved in drug interdiction team operations against organized crime and drug production facilities, and he's now a member of the Siskiyou County Sheriff's Posse. Posse activities include support roles during drug interdiction operations, wildfire emergency response, natural disaster and emergency response, and community outreach and education. So I see Mark pretty frequently up there in Siskiyou County. He does a great job and has a really, really interesting background and a ton of info. So you're going to learn a lot, whether or not you were dying to know more about fire retardant. You'll enjoy our show today. Mark, how the heck is Mother's Day treating you?
Every day is a blessing, especially Mother's Day. My mother has passed on, but I'm very grateful to her because otherwise I wouldn't be talking to you.
We can barely hear you.
Okay, how about now?
Hey, there we go.
A little better.
Okay, so I got to hold this phone like right up to my face.
Sorry about that.
Anyway, if it's if it gets too loud, just holler and I'll back off a little bit.
Definitely.
And also,
not.
I'm very grateful to Cindy because she is a mother and a great partner and my best friend.
And just an all-around nice person. Your wife's great.
Yeah, and she is an all-around nice person, too. So those things combined, I have nothing to complain about.
And our little dogs love her, too.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
But it was a special thing going on.
It's interesting you mentioned the Black Bear Commune because a lot of those people did move on and are now in upper-level positions in places like the Forest Service. And a lot of the environmental groups that sue the Forest Service. In fact, groups of their own employees have sued the Forest Service several times over fire retardant.
Of course they have. I had a feeling there was a connection there, but I actually didn't run down the names, but the suspects were so likely. That story, though, there was also a video about the Black Bear Commune with Peter Coyote, I think. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, so that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
He was one of the guys that they extorted money out of to buy the land.
Yes. So you're missing it if you actually haven't heard that. I would suggest you pop that in your playlist because it's a ton of fun in a terrifying sort of way because these people it's not a fake story, it's real, and they walk among us and now they're in charge of some stuff. So talk about some of the just the flying experience and how, like, flying on fires differs. Obviously, it's scary, but you've flown in a lot of scary things. How is it different from the regular flying that somebody would do?
You know, it's probably a little different from just the regular flying that someone would do, but it's not all that different from a lot of the flying that I used to do. And it's pretty interesting because a lot of the guys I used to work with, that's how I found out about the job, and a lot of the guys I used to work with at the airline worked there. So, it's kind of a neat challenge. It's a lot of, you don't want to say it's fun. I mean, baseball is fun and going to a movie is fun, but I don't know if you really could call that fun, but I call it fun. I guess I have an odd sense of fun.
Well, it's exciting.
it is exciting, and the challenge is getting an airliner that is certified to fly at 685,000 pounds, and even the way we operate it, it's around 400,000 pounds-ish, down 150 feet above the trees, and to be very precise with where you dispense your cargo. I mean, in a sense, it's a cargo airplane, but you don't take the cargo all the way to the next landing. You go about halfway, and you get rid of the stuff, and then you come back empty, and you do it again.
When you're flying that low, Mark, how what's your airspeed?
We usually, the airspeed in the fire traffic area, the maximum is 170 knots. So that's because there are all different sorts of airplanes in the fire traffic area at any given time. In fact, the fire that came pretty close to getting your guys' house, the Fawn Fire, there were so many airplanes there that we literally had, the air boss had to set up different initial positions where groups of airplanes could go and hold and then wait until they were called by the lead plane to go in and drop their load. And during all of that, I mean, this is a coordination nightmare sometimes, especially where there is a pretty large urban-rural interface involved because there are so many airplanes, there's so much involved, the tactics, where the retardant is most useful, where it's most effective. And for us, because we carry around 10,000 gallons at a time, 9,400 gallons to be precise, we're very cognizant that that's about $60,000 worth of the taxpayers' money. So we want to be sure that the retardant is effective and it goes exactly where the lead plane wants it to go, to make sure we're not wasting everybody's money, our own included.
Yeah.
And that airplane costs a lot of money to operate, so you want to be efficient and effective. Once again, it is the taxpayer that's footing the bill for that, and all of the pilots that I'm close with are extremely, extremely cognizant of that fact.
What's the difference between flying the prop tankers versus the jet tankers?
Well, there aren't very many propeller tankers left, and the only ones that are left are turbine engine tankers. So there are no piston engine airplanes left on fires, or at least I'm not aware of any if there are.
Okay.
So they're all turbines, but some of them are turboprop and some of them are jet.
Right.
And,
interesting.
We obviously operate a turbojet, and then the smaller airplanes, the F2s, are turboprop. So they have a jet engine, but it's driving a propeller, and that's the actual motating force for the airplane, if you will.
Well, when we had this conversation the other day, which is what kind of sparked the idea to do this as a program, you were saying that, like, the difference between the release system, some is pressurized and some is basically just gravity?
Gravity.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so the smaller air tankers typically have some kind of gravity system. They have a hopper, and they're usually modified agricultural airplanes. And then some of the airplanes have a pressurized tank system where they literally have tanks inside the airplane, and then those tanks are pressurized with air either generated by the bleed air system of the engines or generated by an external compressor in the case of the 747. So the typical airplane has a pressurized system. Most of them do, the larger air tankers. But our airplane is unique in a very large air tanker. It's unique because it has a gravity system. The tanks are literally on the outside of the plane. They're on the belly of the airplane. So we have a computer control, and then tells the doors to either open or close, and then those doors can be modulated to allow whatever amount you want to get out, and then that is either all of it, some of it, tanks in sequence, tanks consecutive. 1 and 3, 2 and 3, half of it, all of it, you know, whatever it is you want at the time. So
Now so
that makes our airplane unique.
Is the propellant a liquid, or is it a dry powder? What is it?
It comes in various forms. Sometimes it's delivered to the airport as a liquid, and that's becoming more predominant. But a lot of times it's delivered to the airport by the supplier in huge bags. And then those bags are literally put into a mixing hopper, and that mixing hopper is mixed with water. And then from there, that slurry is delivered to the airplane from tanks.
Oh, okay.
And it's very long-lasting. In other words, you can load the airplane, and let's say we're canceled before we take off, and the airplane can sit there for, you know, a week with the stuff in the tank, and then as soon as you start to taxi, it kind of agitates itself and mixes back up again, and it's fine. So there's no shelf life on it once it's in the airplane. Obviously, you don't want to sit forever and ever, but there is no rule on that. So we can sit there loaded all day or for days and days on occasion.
How long does it take typically to reload after you've dumped your load, come back to the airport? How long does it take to take off?
Yeah, typically a DC-10 in commercial operation, where you do all the things that you need to do, even a cargo airplane, not necessarily passenger airplane, but even a cargo airplane, for you to reload the navigation computers and do all the stuff you'd have to do, a pretty good turnaround time would be around 45 minutes or so. Now, in aerial dispensing at a fire, if you're at a good base, and there are several, that has three pumps and three hoses, we have three tanks, so we would want a hose hook to each tank, we can literally bring the airplane in, and from the time we set the brakes, 19 minutes later, we're loaded, refueled, everything's reset, and we're ready to go.
Hmm. Well, so you said you have to reload the... Oh, I'm getting the high sign here. We have to take a break.
I know. It's kind of hard to see our clock today. We do have to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Our guest is Mark Baird, and we are talking about the current push to get rid of fire retardant and why you wouldn't want to do that and what goes into flying on some of these fires. It's kind of an intricate process and probably not something we should be screwing with right here at the beginning of fire season. So you're listening to We the People. You can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
This is Officer Joe with your marijuana safety message. Is your marijuana killing you? A testing of 1,000 NorCal dispensary samples found the majority had toxic mold or substances harmful to humans. As a bud tender, recommended THC products for treatment of medical conditions while you get sicker or exacerbate mental health issues. Get professional medical help and sue the dispensaries for the product and advice liability. Marijuana is not medicine for most Americans, and there's no medicine that is smoked. Remember, let's be careful out there.
Another trusty fire song.
Nice. Mark, you were talking about turnaround times, and you mentioned along with reloading the payload, you have to reload the navigation. What's that mean?
Well, in other words, when you land, the computer goes through a series of events, and one thing is it does your taxiing in and it says end of route, and at that point your navigation computer dumps.
Oh.
So you have to, because we're literally going to a very narrowly defined point in space, obviously you don't want a large airliner just blasting into the fire traffic area willy-nilly and then blowing through the traffic pattern of all the other airplanes there or going where there's active work involved or something else. So we have actually an initial position that's given to us, and it's a coordinate. Latitude and longitude, and that coordinate, and then any other coordinates that are pertinent to avoid Class B airspace or Class D airspace or restricted airspace or military operations areas, all of those things have to be, you have to navigate to those places or around those places, and so that requires inputting information into the airplane's navigation system. Mm-hmm. So that you can do that quickly and easily.
Yeah.
So we have to reload all of that stuff. We have to reset all of the parameters in the airplane, new barometric altimeter settings, get a clearance from ATC and have that in the works while we're reloading, reset headings, reset altitudes, because obviously the altitude you set for your departure not the same as the one you set for an arrival. And you just have to kind of go through all the systems of the airplane and do sort of a pre-flight, if you will, in between flights. It's called a through-flight check. And in addition to that, there is a, you know, a before-start checklist, an after-start checklist, a taxi checklist, a before-takeoff checklist, an after-takeoff checklist, a climb checklist, a cruise checklist, a descent checklist, and then we have to do checklists that are specific to the fire itself, a pre-drop checklist, and then a post-drop checklist as well. And so all of that stuff might have to occur. Let's say, I mean, out of San Bernardino, it's not uncommon to take off and fly to a fire that's 4 minutes away.
Yeah.
And drop your load, and you have to do, and all of those checklists are required. They're not optional. And if you don't do them, you're going to forget something, like to maybe forget to put the gear down or something like that, which is bad. And so you still, no matter how far away the fire is, you still have to do all of that stuff.
Right, right.
And sometimes it is just a continuous exercise. I mean, thank God we have a flight engineer, because that third mouth in the airplane, he is, I've been on fires where that guy is continuously talking, and he's just reading the checklist out loud, and we're going check, set, check, set, check, set, you know, for 5 solid minutes until we touch down and get back in to reload again.
Right.
And then you might have to do that 8 or 9 times in one day.
Hmm. Yeah, more than just, you don't just land and eat your sandwich.
Yeah. Yeah, and in addition to that, well, you don't get a sandwich a lot of times. You just go without.
Yeah,
you don't have time to eat. You don't have time to eat the thing anyway.
I can only imagine
that. We don't run the air conditioning typically in the airplane because it's hard on the machine, the auxiliary power unit, to have to run the airplane, start the engines, and run an air conditioner is just a lot to ask. Because remember, these airliners were meant to take off once, fly across the ocean, land once, and then 4, 5, 6 hours later, do it again.
Right.
When you cycle the airplane 8 or 10 times in one day, it's hard on brakes, tires. I mean, brakes get hot. The brakes get seriously hot. That's one real consideration. And it just is not the intended use of the machine. So we have procedures and processes in place to mitigate those concerns. But unfortunately, they're labor intensive, and oftentimes you can't run the air conditioner. So we're sitting in the airplane, it's 130 degrees inside, trying to get this stuff all moving. And the only time we get any relief is once the airplane is moving, there's enough airflow that you get to use some of it to cool yourself off.
Yeah. Yeah, I never thought about that. Yeah, they are somewhat designed to get in the air and then just fly for long periods of time and not have to go through that constant cycling.
The starting and the stopping.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of like your car. When your car never gets any highway miles, you know, it just is in town sitting in traffic or, you know, things like that.
It kind of
messes it up. You were also saying the other day about the sun damage that, as a pilot, that you get in the cockpit. And I was thinking, you know, I asked you why you guys don't have, you know, the window film of some sort. Not necessarily dark window film, but they have the clear stuff that blocks UV, and I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I mean, the front window is infused with a lot of times like a gold substance, but that's so that you can electrify the windshield and melt any ice you get on the windshield in bad weather. But there can't really be too much UV coating, because when you look through ultraviolet coating, you see rainbows, and you know, under certain angles of the sun and certain weather conditions. So, and it's really important. I mean, you need to spot that lead plane maybe when you're 10 or 15 miles out. So you really, really have to have a as clear a window as you possibly can get. And even sometimes in low light or hazy conditions or smoky conditions, man, that is just that's a real crapshoot as to whether you get the guy in sight in plenty of time or literally at the last second.
Do you have like onboard radar? Like when you're flying in low like that, you're obviously flying through smoke. You're not going to be able to see what's out there, you know, a mile or two in front of you, which comes up pretty fast. How do you keep from getting too close to another plane?
or smacking the ground. I mean, that's another concern because, you know, you're coming in fairly low anyway. Well, there are some innovations that literally are fairly new, and those work well. ADS-B is one real good tool, and that's an area data system broadcast. And that ADS-B is a transponder in the aircraft that literally pushes the signal out and tells what your altitude, what your speed is. Sometimes it even tells the end number of your airplane. And then other airplanes have that, and your machine can interrogate that and show the other aircraft in the area if they're also ADS-B equipped. And it's mandated for most airplanes to be ADS-B equipped after 2020. There are exemptions to that. Those are airplanes that are typically not in the area. That's why we have a temporary flight restriction area that is solely set up by the Forest Service with permission of the FAA. They'll ask for a temporary flight restriction that's 5 or 10 miles in diameter. It depends on the fire. Some of them are huge, some of them are small. And then within that fire traffic area, within that temporary flight restriction area, we also have what's called a fire traffic area. And that's a construct that's a Forest Service generated deal. And there are very specific rules for contact on the radio within so many miles and your airspeed within the fire traffic area, your ingress and egress points, even down to even which direction you turn. And the goal of that stuff is so that everybody in that fire traffic area is always on the same page. And it's repeatability and predictability. So you know what the other airplane's going to do. You follow the same rules they do. You're going the same speed they're going. Now, obviously, for a large airliner, that minimum speed is, that's something you have to take into account because all of the speeds in a large airplane are based on your weight. The heavier you are, the faster you have to go to keep from stalling the airplane.
Right.
But all those things have been taken into account so that the maximum speed in the fire traffic area is 170 knots. And then when you're on the drop, the maximum speed is 150 knots. And everyone can pretty much comply with that. So it's not, it becomes a non-issue.
Well, is that, that's like minimum flight speed for a big plane like that, isn't it? I mean, what do you need to keep it in the air?
Oh, yeah. I mean, our final approach speeds are typically 130.
Yeah. That's a pretty thin margin.
You're flying at 150?
Yeah. So it's a thin margin, but it's calculated. The engineering and the physics works. And you know, unless you're in serious turbulence or up and down drafts, and every once in a while you can get a stick shaker, but it's not typical.
A stick shaker.
The stick shaker is a generated signal in the airplane that literally vibrates the control yoke to let you know that a stall is impending. You're not stalling, but you're getting close. And in a big downdraft off the drop, you can get a little stick shaker, but it's not normal. It's not even typical. And those speeds really do work pretty well for everyone concerned, which is kind of nice.
Yeah.
That sounds
but what we have
kind of terrifying.
What we have more problems with are, fires like the Dixie Fire, which was really big, or even the Fawn Fire, which wasn't terribly big, but it was very destructive, and it was a pretty intense activity for a couple of days, is with recreational flyers that are sightseeing. And they want to get up close to see what the fire looks like.
Oh, boy, I never thought about that.
And some of those guys are not required to have ADS-B, and they don't. And quite frankly, I don't blame them. I mean, it's almost $4,000 to get one of those ADS-B transponders installed in your airplane. So I don't blame a guy that's got a weekend airplane for not wanting to get one. Heck, I wouldn't want one myself if I didn't have to have it. But they'll fly around near the fire, and you don't see them necessarily. So you really, really, really have to have your head on a swivel because news helicopters are another issue. I mean, they'll get as close as they can, and, you know, most of them are pretty responsible, but every once in a while, you find your head on a swivel and you go, "Whoa, I didn't see that guy," So those are issues as well. And then there's terrain, the smoke. Sometimes the smoke is just really thick, and you have to navigate, aviate, and communicate through all of that, make your way to the right spot, and make sure the load goes where it's supposed to go.
Now, when you drop your load, I mean, that stuff's coming in at, like you say, 170 knots. When it hits the ground, I mean, it could potentially do some damage to trees and structures and that sort of thing, can it?
Well, on the drop, the maximum speed is 150, which is a small distinction, but it's still something. But yeah, when that stuff comes out of the bottom of the airplane, you figure water weighs 8 pounds a gallon.
Mm-hmm.
And when you mix retardant with it, now it weighs 9 pounds a gallon. So you're going at 150 miles an hour, and you're dropping something that weighs 9 pounds per gallon. And it's mathematically calculated that if you're at a certain height, and here's what our goal is, to be at an altitude where the retardant stops its forward motion and literally comes down on the ground vertically before it hits the ground. So that's how the drop heights are calculated. That's why the speed is calculated. So because if you're too low, then your drop is too narrow. Obviously, if you're too high, your drop will be too wide and too diffuse. Mm-hmm. If you're going too fast and the stuff is still hauling butt when it hits the ground, it's only going to coat one side of the plant, but it won't coat the other side of the plant.
Right.
Or it'll break the top of a tree off.
Because it just drills in?
Yeah, and it just drills in, but it doesn't get the coating that you want. And ideally, the coating would be the entire plant, both sides, and so that would be more like rain, wouldn't it? It just kind of makes sense.
Sure.
And that's why your speed and your altitude have to be really perfect in order to get the desired results. And obviously, the type of fuel and where you put the line are very important because you won't get the desired result. That's why we thought it was so odd when they wanted to build that wind farm on top of all the ridges near Round Mountain. I mean, that's where the fire retardant, that's where the fire line would go, but you're not going to be able to fly a fire there because those huge windmill things will be on top of right where you would want to put the fire line.
That's a really good consideration.
There are so many considerations to all of these things that it's literally ridiculous. And then you get down to the results of the EAJA and the environmental lawsuits that these people are bringing against their own agencies to try to stop this fire retardant. And you're kind of in a situation of where you have to ask yourself, when do the people involved win one of these things? In other words, the Dixie Fire burned down Greenview. It burned down whole towns. It took hundreds and hundreds of houses. The campfire took out Magalia and took out, literally paradise and hundreds of houses. And everyone literally is concerned about, well, you can't drop on a cultural site. You can't drop on, you can't drop within 300 feet of a terrestrial water course. Well, I've never dropped on a lunar water source. Most of the water sources are terrestrial, but, and so you have to ask yourself, and what is the point of the drop? The point of the drop is to stop the spread of the fire. The retardant does not put a fire out. I mean, if it was a small enough fire and you smashed it directly, yeah, it would smother a fire. But that's not its intended purpose. The intended purpose of the retardant is to prevent the fire from spreading beyond its containment area. So usually that would mean that you would have to anchor the retardant on some geographical thing, either a road, a place where there's no vegetation, or a rock outcropping. I don't want to say this out loud, but a water course, because fire and water just don't do well
together. That would be a terrestrial water course.
Yeah, especially terrestrial water. That's just hell on fire. But so when you anchor your line 300 feet away from the anchor point, well, gee, what do you think the fire is going to do when it gets to that point?
Right.
It's
going
to burn around the end of the line and then just keep on burning. And we saw that happen. I've seen that happen hundreds of times. But it is seemingly more important for these people to be able to sue their own agency and use taxpayers' money to do the lawsuit through the Equal Access to Justice Act. And when it's an environmental case, the lawyers get $700 an hour instead of the usual $150 or $200. So, oddly enough,
and the taxpayer gets to foot the bill for that.
Right. Law firms have sprung up, but their only job is to sue the government over environmental issues for which they get handsomely paid by the Forest Service. Then they walk away with a big fat check, and they don't give a shit what happens to everybody else.
Yeah, whether they win or lose, actually. Which is the real killer of it. We have to take a really quick break on that point so we can ponder lunar water. I didn't have any lunar water songs. I was sorry about that. But we'll be right back. Our guest is Mark Barrett, and you're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
This is Officer Joe with your marijuana safety message. Did you know that the marketing of marijuana is a misogynistic and racist activity? That's right. Most marijuana corporations are owned and controlled by rich, fat cat, white corporate types. And most dispensaries are placed into depressed communities of color. These communities can least afford the chains of drug addiction and corporate greed. For more information about marijuana, please visit sources like ALM, Americans Against Legalizing Marijuana, at www.aalm.info. And remember, let's be careful out there.
Girl, your eyes have a mist from the smoke of a distant fire.
Your eyes have a mist from the smoke of a distant fire.
Your eyes have a mist from the smoke of a distant fire.
You don't really get to have the fire be distant. You guys are like sitting right on top of it. I'm curious, Mark, on the heat, just the heat factor from these enormous. You know, when we have a million acres involved in a fire, when you're flying that low over that, I mean, how does that affect everything? It's got to be the wind and
it was like
just
rubbing your hand over the top of barbecue. I mean, your plane's got to heat up, doesn't it?
Well, it's obviously a big impact, and people say, "Well, why don't you guys just put that out?" And that I understand that. I can understand the sympathy for that and the emotional aspect of that. But the problem becomes that sometimes these fires gain a life of their own, like mm-hmm. the Dixie Fire and a lot of the other fire, even the Fawn Fire for a while. They burn so hot and they move so fast that they not only create their own weather, but the wall of flame on the Dixie Fire, and I have some videos, I'll have to send them to you, or some pictures anyway, where the wall of flame was probably, I'm just guessing, 400 feet high. The smoke coming out of that was just angry. I mean, it was boiling. And the wind and the turbulence, and sometimes the turbulence is so bad that you are really, it's just all you can do to kind of hang on the airplane and keep it pointed right. And most of the lead plane pilots, because they're in a smaller aircraft, which is more adversely affected in turbulence than ours is, you know, we've had them call it a day. They say, look, it's just not navigable. You can't control the airplane in there. And the lead plane guy will say, I'm not going back in there today, or I'm not going back in there until this lets up or the conditions, the atmospherics change. We've had fires. I was on one, I recall, in Santa Barbara, where you're dropping your line right on this ridge top. And because of onshore flow and fire behavior and just a bunch of other factors, you know, the guy says, oh, there's a huge gap in your line, you know, and we're like, because remember, these ridge tops aren't all dead flat or dead level. They go up and down. The trees are different heights and so on. And we did a turnaround back towards the airport, and we could see the line. And sure enough, I mean, there was probably a part of our line that was maybe approaching an eighth of a mile long where there was just no retardant. But then we all came to the same conclusion at once. The wind was going through that saddle so hard that it just blew the retardant away every place where it was low ground compared to the relative height of the ridgetop. So it literally just sucked the retardant away from the path of the drop. Mm-hmm. And those are all things that, you know, that you have to try to take into account, or you're going to be doing them over.
So do you run into situations where you're coming in for a drop and you can't get down to that optimum height and speed where you have to back out and try another pass, or what do you do?
Yeah, sure. You know, and communication is always encouraged, and we have a really super relationship with lead plane pilots and the air attack, which is the air attack circles the fire typically at least 2,000 feet above drop altitude. And then the fire traffic area is 1,000 feet above drop altitude. And then, of course, there's drop altitude, which is considered to be a pattern that's 500 feet above ground level. So typically the air attack and the lead plane, we have really good relationships with those guys. That, you know them by their first name. You know who's out there. You're used to them. You've worked with them probably. There aren't that many. And so it's not considered inappropriate for you to say, hey, you know what, this doesn't look good to me. What if we tried it from west to east instead of east to west? And those suggestions are almost always listened to, unless the guy's been through there enough to say, no, trust me, this will work. I've been through here 18 times today. And usually you take his advice because he's mm-hmm. done it more than you.
Well, it's nice that you can make those on the fly decisions that maybe the original attack plan isn't going to work, and you can make a call and change it on the spot.
Oh, you can. And I remember a fire last year in Oregon where something like that happened because we were losing the light. It was getting toward dusk. They wanted to kind of peg up one section of line if they could before it got dark. And, you know, their goal is to kind of get it tightened up as much as they can so that the ground crews overnight don't face any blowouts or any real big emergencies. I mean, you know, our job is to try to make it so ground firefighters can accomplish their tasks and not be put in danger. That's really what our mission is. So we had one where we were losing the light. The line itself was starting to shadow because of the proximity of a ridge. And, you know, we got online a couple of times and just couldn't see where the lead plane wanted us to put the load. So we made the suggestion, hey, why don't we turn this around and come from the other direction where we have the sun at our back instead of in our eyes. And we turned it around and we were able to make a successful drop and everybody was happy. So, yeah, that happens all the time.
Hmm. Interesting.
How do you, I guess it's one of those things that you kind of work your way into, but how do people wind up flying on fires? I mean, you have to have had a tremendous amount of experience before you get into a deal like that, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, typically the guys that are doing that are they're relatively experienced pilots. And, you know, obviously there has to be an entry path. You know, for our airplane, typically that would be as a pilot who's also qualified as a flight engineer. We have a young guy right now who's working his way up to be a pilot. He has a lot of mechanical experience, got a lot of flight engineer experience, very, very sharp young guy. And once he gets his hours, then he'll have a pathway to sit in the co-pilot seat until after several years of experience, he'll move to the pilot seat. And otherwise, a lot are retired airline pilots, pilots who have retired from full careers and other jobs. They have a ton of flight experience, and then they get an opening to move over into one of these deals. And so it's really, there are various ways to get into it. There are a lot of aerial applicators, crop dusters, and they break into it that way. We have a couple of guys that flew smoke jumpers for years and years and years. So they have a lot of experience, maybe not in heavy airplanes, but they have a lot of experience just flying around near fires and the terminology and the process and procedure. And so they're a natural fit. So literally more than a few ways to get into it.
Hmm. So how many people are in the plane when in one of the big airliners that you're flying on a fire? How many folks are actually in the cockpit managing that plane?
In the very large air tanker, there are three: a flight engineer, captain, and co-pilot. And then in the large air tankers, they call them, and those are the ones that typically hold 3,000 gallons or so, there are usually two pilots, a captain and a first officer.
Okay.
God, I just, you've been, how long have you been flying on the fire side of it?
I think a little over 7 years.
So were they always using, I know that the retardant has changed over time, but I don't know when that took place.
Yeah, the retardant is, seems like it's constantly morphing. I mean, when I started, there was the stuff called LC, which was liquid concentrate. And then it was, it changed to MVP, which was a more environmentally sensitive retardant that didn't work quite as well. And that's medium viscosity FosCheck, that's called. And then there's this other stuff we started using last year that's a real foamy stuff. It's a little less effective, and sometimes you have to go do it twice or double wide the line. And, you know, usually those are the result of environmental lawsuits or some echo not in a government agency that says, well, you know, yes, it might be less effective, but we won't kill a fish this way. I mean, it's just, you know, stuff like that. And I don't really know. I'm not probably not the expert on the timeline.
No, I was just curious because I know it has changed, and it. My general sense of it is that every time we change it, we make it less effective.
Pretty much. Every time you change that, it becomes less effective, yeah.
So when you first started flying it, has it always been, I'm assuming it's always been red?
Yeah, all the stuff we use is red.
Okay.
And is that added just so you can see where your load landed, or is that a nature of the chemical?
No, it's added. I mean, that's iron oxide. It's basically a bucket full of rust and mixed at a certain, percentage relative to the entire load. But it's just iron oxide, and the only reason it's in there is so that if you're making repeated drops or you need to evaluate what you've just done, it's kind of like bomb damage assessment photographs.
Sure.
Right.
You know, it's easy to see where you put the stuff. And if you're the next airplane and you're supposed to tag on to the end of that line and continue the line, you know, oftentimes we'll have maybe 10, 15 aircraft because we're building a line along some ridge toward an anchor point.
That makes sense.
Not a waterway, though. And you know, if you're airplane number 3 through 15, you have to see where the last guy quits to see where you need to pick up and have just a tiny bit of overlap to make sure there are no gaps in the line. And the red stuff is the only way you can do that.
So it's not not a chemical. It's basically just rust.
It's just a bucket of rust. And it's interesting because in Australia, you drop primarily water or gel, which is water mixed with a gelatin-type compound that keeps the water from evaporating before it hits the ground. And it is the devil to see where you put your last load. I mean, 15 minutes later, you can't see the stuff.
Oh.
So, yeah. And it's just not as effective.
Is the iron oxide, is that what they have the problem with?
The environmental?
I'm not really sure what they have the problem with, because I was sitting here cruising a Forest Service publication where in 2008, after they got sued again, and then, you know, in these environmental lawsuits, you have usually three options. Option one is don't use whatever it was you were using before to do whatever it was you were doing before. Don't use it at all. And then the ramifications of those things are listed in a table. And then option two is do it exactly the way the environmentalists want you to do it, in light of the fact that you're not going to stop doing it at all. So let's say you go through court and you're going to present these three options, and those are the results of the court order. Well, option one is don't do anything. And that's obviously not going to fly, because you do need some aerial application on these fires. Option two is do what the environmentalists recommend you do, and that's usually typically way, way, way less effective than what you would want to do, but it's marginally more effective than not doing aerial application at all. And then option three is what usually ends up happening, and that's what the director of the Forest Service at the time chose. And it was kind of funny because, you know, you have effect
hold,
on...
Hold that thought, Mark. We'll come back with Forest Service right after the news. Our guest is Mark Barrett. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People.